What is our problem? The fourth talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by David Crabtree on October 17, 2000, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The idea behind this series is that we at the Study Center have been studying the Bible for a number of years and have been, in particular, trying to clarify in our minds what is the essential message of the Bible? What is the gospel? And our thinking has been sharpened as we interact with one another. And our thinking has changed over time. And it seemed like this would be a good time for us to all sit down and give thought to how we would encapsulate the message that we have found in Scripture. And our goal is to try to go through this and present the essential message of the Bible in the clearest terms that we can manage. C.S. Lewis wrote that he thinks that the test for graduating from seminary should include taking a theological concept or theological tenet and explain it to a man on the street in terms that he can understand. And that's kind of what we're doing here, is we're trying to find a way to explain the essential message of the Bible in terms that anybody could understand. We are trying to avoid using the words that you would typically hear in this kind of discussion. And the reason for that is because those words have been used in so many different ways that whenever you use them, you run as great a risk of being misunderstood as being understood. So we're trying to avoid those kinds of church words and yet still explain the Bible as clearly as we possibly can. Tonight's topic is, what is our problem? It is, in my view, the most important topic of the ten. Naturally, because I'm doing it. But there's another reason, too, and that is because I think it is the most important of the ten. Because if you don't understand this one, the other nine don't really matter. And so I hope that I can explain this particularly well. I feel the gravity of the task. I hope that I'm up to it. Okay. The first part of my task here, I think, is relatively easy. History has made it easy. We are living at a time when we have many years of human history behind us that we can look back upon. And I think that it is clear that there is evil in mankind. Someplace in mankind there is evil. If you look at the history of Western civilization, people were not always convinced of that. But by the time we get to World War I, and then following up with World War II, worldwide, people have no doubts that there is evil within mankind. Those were horrendous events in which millions and millions of people were put to death. Senseless death. And in conjunction with that, there was another event which is held up as the epitome of evil, and that was the Holocaust, in which a whole race was exterminated by their countrymen, people who were their neighbors, for no reason, for no reason of guilt. It is truly an amazing event that took place. Last week, Wes talked about how capable man is, and that's very true. Man is very creative, is able to accomplish amazing things. But if you combine what man is able to accomplish with his evil, it becomes horrendous evil. And the Holocaust is one example of that. Not only technological developments, but there are other developments that make greater evil possible. I recommend a book by Hannah Arendt. I have mentioned this in other contexts, but I'll mention it again. I read it this summer and it had a huge impact on me. It's called Eichmann on Trial in Jerusalem, I believe. Hannah Arendt was a newspaper reporter who was sent to Jerusalem to cover the trial of Adolf Eichmann. And then she wrote a book based on the transcripts from that trial. Adolf Eichmann was the one who was in charge of making sure that the Jews got from the places where they were first gathered to the extermination camps. So he was, his job was to make sure that the trains were there on time, that they left on time, and that they arrived on time at the extermination camps. During the Nuremberg trials, most of those who were on trial blamed Eichmann, that Eichmann was the key man in this whole thing. In the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem, it became clear that he wasn't really the key man. He was just a facilitator. He was just someone who was figuring out this puzzle of how you get boxcars from here empty to here full. And Eichmann's defense was always, I was just following directions. Hannah Arendt, at the end of the book, the epilogue is the best part of the book. What she says is, we have created a system, a state system, in which horrendous evil can be done for which no one feels responsibility. The people who ordered the Jews to be killed were so far from the killing that they felt no responsibility. And the ones who did the killing felt no responsibility because they were just doing what they were told. So it's not just technological developments that have allowed us to do horrendous evil. It's also the development of the state as we have it, the development of bureaucracies. There are other things that we have developed that allow us to have distance between our act of evil and the consequences, the actual carrying out of the evil. She points out, just one further note, she points out that initially the people who were putting to death the Jews were SS officers. They had to discontinue that because those SS officers soon could not sleep at night. And so they had instead, they had Jews kill Jews with the threat of death if they did not. Even they had a conscience. So man is capable of horrendous evil, truly horrendous evil. But that doesn't mean that everyone is evil. However, we do have an indication that there is a lot of evil. It is widespread. We see widespread social decay. If we look in our own society, there are problems of divorce, problems of abortion, problems of suicide, child abuse and spousal abuse. And we could go on. You all know the litany of things that we could list. But there are social evils that are clear indications that something is wrong within mankind. And I think that everyone would agree that there is something wrong within mankind. And it is interesting that there would be unanimity on such a point. However, people would place the blame variously. Is it due to poverty? Is it due to intolerance? Is it due to racism? Is it due to a lack of education, etc., etc.? So placing the blame is difficult, There's a lot of disagreement about that. But the fact that there's something wrong, I think there's little disagreement on. From the biblical perspective, the answer is quite clear and quite simple. The problem is man is bad. Every man is bad, and every man is bad all the time. Now that's a very strong statement, and it's a difficult statement in the context in which we live, where we see acts of kindness done all the time, all around us. How can I say that every man is bad all the time when we look out and see acts of kindness? Even something trivial like someone holding the door for me when I go through the door. Or a neighbor who bakes cookies and brings them over. And there are greater acts of kindness, people saving the life of another person. Well, this claim that every man is bad all the time only makes sense if we understand what the Bible means by good. We were created to live the way God intended us to live, and that is in obedience to Him. Now, there are two ways to be obedient. Think of a father and a son. First of all, a son can be out and out disobedient, obviously. But a son can be obedient in two different ways. One way a son can be obedient is to be what I would call a rule follower. Whatever laws the father lays down, the son does. And he does them because those are the rules. The other way that a son could be obedient is what I would call a soulmate. That is, everything that the father says to do, the son does, because the son is embracing the values of the father. And here's where the difference shows up. What if the son can act without the father having any chance of knowing what the son has done? If the son is just a rule follower and there is no chance of the father knowing what he has done, he will do what he wants to do. Maybe he'll follow the rule, maybe he won't, but he'll do what he wants to do. The son who is obedient as a soulmate will do what the father would want, because he is embracing the values of the father and taking them as his own. The one who's a rule follower still reserves the possibility of standing in judge over the values of the father. By that analogy, then, what God requires of us is that we be soulmates with Him. He wants us not only to be obedient, but He wants us to embrace His values as our values and to be loyal to Him as a God. So it's that loyalty, then, that becomes critical. To fail to do this is to be a rebel. And that's the term that I'm going to use for someone who does not embrace God's values. This rebellion, then, is what the Bible talks about as the essence of evil. Okay. To get at this, let's talk a little bit about the story in Genesis and the fall. Now, I'm not going to read in Genesis, I'm just going to relate to you the essential parts of the story. But before I do so, it is important that everything that we say, that you take and consider in light of what Scripture actually says. I encourage you that you go home and look at the passages and reflect upon the passages yourself. Because I don't want you to take anything on my authority. I would like you to take it on the authority of Scripture itself. What I am saying is a suggestion as to how Scripture ought to be understood. You need to go and check it out for yourself. In the story in Genesis, if you'll recall, God had made Adam and Eve and had placed them in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, there was a tree called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. God told them not to eat of it. That, he said, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. The serpent came to Adam and Eve, and the serpent said, he urged them to eat of it. He said, you surely shall not die. For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will become like God. In other words, the serpent was urging Adam and Eve to decide for themselves what they would do and what they would not do. He was urging them to take life into their own hands, to become their own master, to be independent, to decide for themselves what was right and what was wrong. God made us in His likeness. We were made in the likeness and the image of God. In the context of Genesis, I think what is being pinpointed there is we were made to be the proper kind of vehicle to display the moral character of God. Last week, Wes listed a number of features about man that are like God. And I agree with the list that he gave. Man is creative, he's capable, he's a person, etc., etc. He makes choices. I agree with that list, but the thing that brings coherence to it all is that we were made to be suitable vehicles for manifesting moral character. We had to have all of those qualities in order to be such a suitable character vehicle. If we didn't have choice, how could we be a moral being? If we didn't have reason, how could we be a moral being? Etc., etc. I think all of those are necessary for us to be suitable moral beings. What God wants to highlight in His creation is His character, and first and foremost, His moral character. There's a sense in which that's the thing that is most distinctive about God. That's the thing of which He is most proud. And He made us as the pinnacle of creation to be capable of reflecting that same character in ourselves. So that's the sense in which God intended us to be like Him. That we would reflect the same kind of love and mercy and patience and peace and the whole list of other attributes that can be ascribed to God. But in the garden, man chose to be like God in a different sense. Man chose to be like God in the sense of having the power and the prerogatives of God. What we would like to do is be the center of the universe. Be in a position where we can arrange everything around us to our liking, to suit us. Sitting back with our feet up on the coffee table and relaxing. And everything to our liking. Everyone doing what we would like them to be doing all around us. Wouldn't that be great? But we were not made to be gods. The universe is not big enough for two gods. As a result, then, by aspiring to be gods and living like gods, we are rebels. And we are not only rebels, but we are self-deluding rebels. That's the worst part. It is interesting to me that everyone has a strong sense of justice. I think one of the reasons we have a strong sense of justice is because God made us moral beings. We want things to be right. The only problem is we all have a different definition of what justice is. My children, I have often commented to my children that they want things to be fair. But they all have this definition of fair that means to my advantage. Things aren't fair. What they mean is things are not to my advantage. If things are to their advantage, they have no complaint. They aren't worried about fairness. It's only when things are not to their advantage that they're worried about fairness. We all have a sense of justice. And because we have a sense of justice, we want everything that we do to be justified. No matter what I do, it's the right thing. Even if someone kills someone else, there's always a justification for it of some sort. He had the money that I wanted. He got in my way. I mean, there are any number of excuses, but there's always some justification for it. And as a result, we go through life justifying everything that we do. And by justifying everything we do, we cover up the fact that we ever do anything wrong. We fool ourselves. That's what we do best, is fool ourselves. What is curious, though, is when you look at other people around you, you see them fooling themselves. You see their flaws and the fact that they are oblivious to those flaws. What makes us think that we are exempt? That we alone are exempt? Not likely. Okay. So the problem is, how can we come to see the nature of that rebelliousness within us, the evil that's within us, if we are so self-deluded? Ultimately, the only way is an act of God. It takes an act of God to break down that facade of self-justification. And apart from that, it won't happen. However, God has built into our reality and our experience some attention-getting devices. Let me go back to what it says in Genesis. After Adam and Eve had eaten of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God came to them. And first, he proclaimed a curse on the serpent. But then he turns to the woman, and then he turns to the man. And in both cases, he gives them examples of how life will be different now as a result of what they have done. To the woman, he says, there are two, I think, pictures that he is painting. And I hope I get them in the right order. The first one, he turns to woman and he says, there's one other thing here. In all of these pictures that he paints, in each case, he is referring to some God-given desire, a desire that's built into man right from the beginning. And then he points to that desire and he says, but you will not be able to fulfill it. So first he turns to the woman and he says, your desire shall be for your husband, but he shall rule over you. So the first picture is, woman has built into her a desire to become one with her husband. But now, as a result of this rebelliousness, instead of that oneness, it's going to end up being a lopsided, a distorted kind of relationship in which the tendency will be for the man to take advantage of his position as head. So that's the first. In other words, marriage will not provide the kind of fulfillment and satisfaction that it ought to provide. Second, God will increase their pain in childbirth. Another, the second built-in desire for woman is to have children. That's natural and that's good. That's from God. But as a result of the rebelliousness, that is going to be a difficult and painful process. It will be, God says, you will not get satisfaction and fulfillment from that. You won't be able to fully fulfill that desire. He turns to the man. Work is going to be futile. The man was built with a desire to gain significance and importance and a sense of satisfaction from his work. But as a result of man's rebelliousness, he won't be able to do it. His work will be filled with futility. And he won't be able to get satisfaction and fulfillment from it. And then the second snapshot of the man's life afterwards, after as a result of rebellion, is you are going to die. That we want to be significant. We want to have our life have meaning. But instead of that, we are going to die. You won't be able to get meaning and significance from this existence because it's only short. It's like a sandcastle on the beach. It's only going to last till high tide. And after high tide, there will be no trace of it whatsoever. How can you get meaning and significance out of an existence of which there will be no trace left in 50 to 100 years? I mean, think about it. How long does a person leave their stamp in this world? It's brief. It's pathetically brief. So the sum total of all these things, and there are other things, is that life is a futile and frustrating experience. We are constantly trying to find fulfillment somewhere. But no matter where we turn, it just kind of slips through our fingers. There's nothing left. I remember when I was in high school, I wanted very, very badly to buy a scuba tank and a regulator. And I saved up for a long period of time to get it. And one came on sale, and I ran down with the money that I had, and I purchased it, and I brought it home, and I put all of the pieces out in the living room and unwrapped them and put them together and felt sick to my stomach. You've all probably had a similar kind of experience where you have your expectations become so inflated that there is nothing on earth that can fulfill that. It's impossible. And then the sense of failure, that sense of I didn't get, it's not what I wanted, it's not doing it. That's the kind of futility that characterizes our existence. And God did that because he wanted to show us we aren't very good gods. We are not the stuff of gods. We don't make very good gods. We can't even fulfill the most basic desires that are in us. What kind of a God is that? We're going to die. What kind of a God is that? We weren't made to be gods. We are not gods. And in fact, we are helpless to gain satisfaction and meaning in our lives. The only way that that will come is from God. So the futility that we experience in life is put there for a redemptive purpose. It's put there to help us. It's put there to help shatter that facade we have that everything is wonderful, that all is right with the world. It's there to tell us all is not right with the world, but something has to change. Something is dreadfully wrong. So there are two ways then that we can deal with this futility as we begin to sense it and experience it. One is to ignore it and go on living our lives as if we can find meaning and fulfillment in this world. If that's the choice that we make, then our life will be filled with ever more and more futility and frustration. That's guaranteed. The other possibility is for us to look at that futility and frustration and say, I cannot make this life what it's supposed to be. I can't gain the meaning and fulfillment that I meant to have. God help me, because I can't do it. In other words, that futility is designed to face us into our own rebelliousness against God. And if we turn towards God and face into that rebelliousness and renounce that rebelliousness, then that is the beginning of the healing. It's at that point that God enters into our lives and begins this transformation process whereby we can become not just capable of reflecting the character, the moral character of God, but will indeed one day manifest the moral character of God. It's really an amazing God that would create us and see us turn, be the rebels that we are, and yet reach out his hand to us and face us into a rebelliousness and then take the initiative to transform us. What we see in God's character as a result of this is his patience, his love, and his loyalty to us. And it is an amazing story that is repeated time and time again in the lives of believers. Okay. That is all that I had planned to say. I am open to any questions or comments that you have. Yes, Michael.
When someone like a
His question, let me repeat it. His question is, if a general orders a soldier to kill someone, who is responsible? Who is responsible for that killing? Is that your question?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And is it necessarily wrong?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. We are responsible for any wrongdoing. Let me give you my short answer, and then I'll give you a longer answer. My short answer is, first of all, warfare is a difficult issue. And in warfare, killing is not necessarily the same thing as murder. However, it seems to me that even in warfare, murder happens. And that if someone is commanded to murder, that they ought not do it. Okay, that's my short answer. Now the longer answer. This stuff gets really tricky. I have been thinking about this since I read Hannah Arendt's book. She says, it is probably the case that most anyone put in Adolf Eichmann's position would have done the same thing that he did. She says he's culpable of the wrongdoing, but we all probably would have done the same thing. Think of yourself in the position of a bureaucrat. We had And the reason I've been thinking about this is because I've been running into bureaucrats. We have a pasture at our house that we turned into a soccer field, and the county sent us a letter saying that that was illegal. You can't have people playing soccer on agricultural land, and there are obvious reasons for that that escape me. But the thing that's interesting about this is the only people I can talk to are bureaucrats. They're the ones that are doing all of this. You talk to them, and most of them will say, this is ridiculous. You should be able to play soccer on that pasture. And they're very sympathetic, and you think you're making great strides. You're almost getting there to the place where you can open the field up. And they say, but you can't do it. Because they're bureaucrats. And a bureaucrat, the wonderful thing about a bureaucracy is it's designed to remove any judgment out of every position. Because if you exercise judgment as a bureaucrat, then you're messing up the system. So you are supposed to be a judgmentless person. Whether it's right or wrong is never supposed to enter into your thinking. Well, that's an amazing structure to have layers and layers of bureaucrats for whom it is a virtue never to exercise judgment. That allows for enormous evil, even evil that isn't intended. Because when the lawmaker makes his law, he is so far removed from the impact of that law, he doesn't know all of the impacts of that law. How could he possibly anticipate all of the ramifications of that law? The only people that know all of the ramifications of those laws are the low-ranking bureaucrats who implement them. But they are supposed to have no judgment. So you can have horrendous evils taking place for which the lawmaker feels no responsibility and the bureaucrat feels no responsibility. It's an amazing situation. And I think of myself, what if I was in that position of the bureaucrat? I'd do the same thing. I'd probably do the same thing. It is truly amazing what we have created.
So are you saying that a soldier is a bureaucrat with a gun?
I mean, the traits of a soldier are the same as the traits of a good bureaucrat, and that is, all judgment is removed, you do what you're told to do, and you put things into neat categories.
Well, first of all, about your problems, it's called the bureaucrat to tell them your cattle have learned to play soccer, what can you do? Just to see what happens. And I was in the Navy, and at least in the U.S., I think the military people know, were actually told, you know, if you were given an unlawful order, you know, such as murdering defenseless people or, you know, doing very immoral things, then you can, you know, go against that, but you know, it'll be... There's going to be, like, you know, trials and all that, so be prepared for that, so you better be sure. That's only in the United States. Germany, if you're ordered to do something immoral, you better do it or you're dead.
Well,
and then going on to the example earlier with the guy with the trains, he wasn't, you know, he was part of the chain, and I think, you know, there, you know, that's still, you know, the gray area. But when you get to the part where the people are putting together the gas showers and stuff, there's no question there. The guy, you know, scheduling the trains, he may have suspected there was something going on. I don't know the trials. I don't know if he actually knew.
Early on, he did not know. And that is one of the findings that she made. But early on, he did not know what was happening.
I imagine,
and later on, he did.
I imagine that was on purpose with the bureaucracy.
Right.
He probably suspected after a while.
I recommend that you see the series Shoah if you have not seen it. Shoah is a documentary that was done on the Holocaust by a man, a Jewish man, who was sent to one of the death camps, but he survived the Holocaust and moved to the United States, grew up in Chicago, and began to have questions as to why did this happen and how did it happen. And so he went back to Germany and Poland and interviewed people who were his old neighbors, people who were in the police in the village where he grew up. And he goes, the whole course that he went from his village to the death camps, he interviewed as many people who were involved in that process as he possibly could. And his conclusion was that a huge percentage of the population of the country were in one way or another involved in getting the Jews to the death camps and putting them to death. Secondly, most of them went to great lengths to be as ignorant as they could be about what was happening. They could easily have known more. They made a conscious effort not to know more because they were afraid of what they would find out. And by avoiding knowing more, they could feel less guilty for what had happened. And that same pattern is seen in Eichmann. Eichmann, very early on, he did not want to know what was happening with the Jews that were being shipped out. Very early on, however, he took steps to try to help some groups of Jews to escape death. But as time went on, that became more difficult, more risky, and he just stopped even trying to do that.
A lot of what you're saying in the Holocaust about like different roles that people played, like the thing about the Holocaust is that it's so easy for people to see, and y'all, like, the whole room like moans with sadness when you say, oh, everybody helped because they were so in there. Whatever, like that, I mean, that's true, but that happens every day in every house, everywhere, in every relationship. I mean, why don't people pay attention to that? That's what I want.
Well, right. And that's absolutely right, that it is the nature of the evil within us that it is, in some instances, it is very blatant and very clear. But in many instances, it is very subtle.
But sometimes you can still see it.
You can see it, but we see it best in others. It's seeing it in ourselves that becomes really, really difficult. We don't like, we look away very quickly. Yes?
Not to change the thing you thought, but you were right to stumble over which came first. It was actually childbearing pain. I just wrote a paper on it. So I showed up here and you're talking about something. I just spent the last 28 hours thinking.
Can you speak a little bit to this business of futility? You were saying that God designed it so that life would be futile.
Yes.
And yet we look around sometimes, and not because it didn't prove it, as I approach this, a person like that is writing symphonies or writing music or writing books and so forth. You know, I look at them and they don't seem to exhibit a frustration or, you know, a futility. They seem to have a sense of meaning,
right.
And that what's in the equation that they're not picking up, that that life is futile. And like it ties in with what went on last week, where they're exhibiting some of the creative things of being just a person.
Right.
They don't get it with God.
No.
I am confident that if you observed such a person close up, what you would see is futility. I will use an example of someone that I know who is very successful in his business. He is very wealthy, and he can't sit still. And I'm confident that the reason he can't sit still is because he knows if he sits still too long, his mind will go. He'll start thinking about life, and he can't take that. So it's off to some other activity, or some other activity. So from the outside, he's very successful. And he's found, but there is futility there, but he's found a way to mask it. And he's masking it with activity. As long as he's busy, then he doesn't have to think about it. But he knows the world is falling apart all around him. His son's life is falling apart, largely because of the fact that he neglected his son as a child. And every once in a while he kind of looks into that, but then it's off skiing or something, off hiking, off doing something, because if you sit there too long, it'll all kind of crash down on you. I'm confident that anyone you look at who appears to have overcome the problems of futility, it is only momentary. It won't last. If you spend enough time with them, the futility will manifest itself. Roger?
Two things about futility. Talking about the creative arts. Anybody who's taken a trip to the library probably knows that there's a lot of books in the library. Somebody wrote those books, and they're probably, most of them are forgotten. And then, to top that off, I'm thinking of the library at Alexandria. So not only is your book lost in the library, in an obscure corner of the library, but libraries end up being burnt to the ground. Secondly, my wife's definition of futility is to have the food and the toilet paper in the shop.
I just have something to say regarding his question about, you know, some people that are successful and wonder where is there futility in their life. And from my own experience, I believe people put on their best in front of other people. But when they're by themselves, that's when the futility hits. And then in the darkness of their own home or room or whatever.
I think that's very true. It's all part of our self-deception, but we also want to deceive others as well. And
we don't want to appear
weak. Right. We don't want people to know that we're failures. And yet that's exactly what I mean by futility, is God has guaranteed that we will fail apart from Him. Yes.
The title of this talk is "What is Our Problem?" So it seems like it's really an inherited problem, one that was passed down to us. We don't have a choice but to be infected by it simply by existing. And I'm still, I didn't come to your brown bag lunch on Thursday, but I'm still wrestling over night number one. In what way are we culpable of having been born into this situation that none of us can escape? And yet God still somehow holds us responsible for that.
Well, we make the choices that we make. And by making those choices, we make rebellious choices.
But we were given a rebellious nature. From which we want to make rebellious choices.
Right. Right.
Which is pretty good.
Is why?
Pretty futile.
Right, right. And apart from God's activity in our lives, we won't face into that. what would benefit.
Related to that, when it says in Genesis 3 that for God knows the day you're eating, you can your eyes are open. In what way were our eyes closed before?
Well, I think what the serpent was suggesting that man would realize his full potential. In fact, man's eyes were opened to his evil, to the nature that's in him.
Well, I'm inclined to think, yes, that it was at the time of the fall that it was manifested, but that he was made
with this propensity to be rebellious right from the beginning.
Again, then, back to Jack's kind of example, that was part of his story writing from the very beginning.
Yes.
Okay. Is that? I always think it confuses me there.
About his comment about then why are we held culpable? It may not be this. What I'm about to say may not be well explored, maybe even bad around it. There's no reason as a created being into a futile system that we need be nothing more than an illustration of God's redemption. Culpability or not, I'm a created being. The choices I make, as futile as they might be, and as inherent as they might be, because we were inherently evil, if it's nothing more than to show the grace of God and the glory of God, we might not want to complain.
We can be thankful.
Really thankful that that's the role that God chose for us. And out of nothing that we deserve. Yes?
It's easy for me to think about utility for other people who I probably pursuits, like the guy that you're talking about. But what about utility in a Christian's life who has a ministry and who has all these plans of what they're going to do for God and all that stuff? How does futility show up in that? Or does it?
Once in a while. It shows up absolutely everywhere. Okay. The question is, it's easy to see this futility in the lives of other people, but how about in the life of a Christian who may be in ministry and that sort of thing? Who has not seen a relationship where you have a relationship with someone else that for some reason turns sour, just falls apart? I mean, who hasn't seen that? That's futility. I mean, why is it that everything turns to dust? Why is it that everything disintegrates in our hands? That's futility. It happens all the time to all of us.
Even the word
sometimes
leave you
with
Absolutely. I'm a little confused about the Tower of Babel. I mean, it seems that man kind of defeats himself in the end. Look at, like, philosophies basically nowhere now. And, like, that man's rebelliousness leads him to a dead end. And yet, why did he step into the Tower of Babel? Why did he come out of the sky and swat everything down? I don't understand.
Why did he swat everybody down?
Yeah. Why did he actually take an active role in destroying that little game right there?
Well, the Tower of Babel.
So the question is, why did God come down and intervene in the way that he did at the Tower of Babel? God did there overtly what he does everywhere. And it's the same thing that you see in Genesis that I was talking about when he told Adam and Eve how things would be different as a result of their rebelliousness. At the Tower of Babel, they said, "Let us make a tower, a city and a tower that reaches into the sky, that I can't remember what, that we make a name for ourselves and we will not be scattered." So they want to do, they say specifically they want to do three things: make a city with a tower that reaches into the sky, make a name for themselves, and avoid from being scattered. God's strategy is the very same that we see elsewhere, and that is he guarantees their failure. What happens? God comes down and he makes sure that the tower and the city are not built. Rather than becoming famous, they became infamous, and they were scattered over the face of the earth. So God's strategy is the same there. It's more overt, it's more dramatic, but it's the same that we see in our lives all the time, and that is, apart from God, whatever we do apart from God, God's strategy is to guarantee that we fail. Why? Because he wants to point us into the reality that we are not gods, that we're rebels, and apart from him, there is no life. There's only death. It says that in God told them, in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. They didn't die, right? They didn't drop dead. But there's another sense in which they did die, and that is this futility.
Would you say that a believer's feeling of futility is less than a non-believer's futility? And your answer is what?
That's a hard one to answer. There's a sense in which a non-believer, I think, would have more futility. But a non-believer has come up with ways to ignore it. A believer is going to face into it more. And so there may be a sense in which a believer will feel it more acutely. But God is going to work in the lives of believers, and he begins the process of bringing life, eradicating some of that futility and making them what man was intended to be. So there's a sense in which, as a believer, one begins to experience some of the opposite of futility and death, that is life, that is peace and love and the things that God wants to build into us. But only a measure in this life. So on the one hand, we probably see the futility more clearly, but it's still a part of our lives as believers. But God begins the process of pushing some of that back.
So you would say those distractions that an unbeliever has actually works? So it's like the guy you were telling that moves around. I mean, he's moving around because he knows in his mind that if he stops, he'll have to think about it. So therefore, he is thinking about it. Therefore, because he is, he is
this. Right. It's a way for him to be able to deny the futility that's there. It's there, but he's able to deny it to himself and say it's not there.
To make a how-to question out of this, but you know, I'm going to go ahead and phrase it. In what ways can a Christian either A, recognize, or B, help prevent themselves from plunging headlong into increasing their own futility? I have a vague sense that most of the Christians I know, especially including myself, often spend years not realizing that energy spent in a certain direction or ways of relating to people, you turn around 5-10 years later, you go, "My God, what a futile thing I've done," you know? And you don't know it until way back in the rearview mirror.
Right.
You've got all these miles of water under the bridge.
Right. So the question is, how can a believer, is there anything that a believer can do to avoid some of that futility?
In the moment, instead
yes.
of like years down the road.
Right. Right. Ultimately, that's a work of God. But very practically, it seems to me the most important thing that we can do is something that is very difficult to do, and that is to be honest with ourselves. We are so good at self-justification that we are good at lying to ourselves. It's a habit that we develop early on, and it's a habit that's very difficult to break. And being ruthlessly honest with ourselves and what we are doing and why we are doing it is probably the best way of breaking away some of our own self-protection, some of the things that keep us from seeing who we really are for what we are. Yes?
Last week, Wes talked about man being transcendent. I was wondering if you would take a stab at describing what he meant.
Man being transcendent?
Yeah.
Could somebody help me?
I think Wes's point is that man has an innate desire for transcendence.
Okay, mm-hmm. That would be very good.
To transcend himself,
yes,
and his circumstances.
Now we can have conversations with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Hey, self.
Hey, self, how you doing? Right. But it's a kind of so it's a kind of self-awareness then. Is that?
Yeah. Self-consciousness, self-awareness.
So that we can. There's a sense in which we are able to step outside of ourselves and look at ourselves.
Examine ourselves. Is that the notion that he was talking about?
That's what I understood. So would that be like being honest with ourselves?
That we are capable of that.
Yes.
Right. It seems to me we are capable of a kind of transcendence in which we think we are stepping out of ourselves and looking at ourselves, but we are stepping out and looking at what we would like to be ourselves, which is not real transcendence. Yes?
There's an aspect of that quest for transcendence that we as rebels that are trying to be God. We attempt to overcome our limitations and become frustrated and alienated, and you know, we don't want to die, so we try to find ways to extend life. We don't want to be held to the ground, so we try to find ways to fly. We don't want to be held to the earth, so we try to find ways to get
right
outside of the atmosphere. I mean, we are constantly seeking ways to overcome our limitations so that we might transcend ourselves.
So that's in that sense, our desire for transcendence is pathological. There's a problem, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, something I haven't heard mentioned yet in the quest for transcendence or self-reliance, it sounds like, to be able to examine the self, I think that as far as I've felt, prayer would be absolutely essential and primary in the discovery of what is true or what is not in your life. Without the spectacles of truth that God gives us, and begging for those things to keep our vision from being tainted, I don't see how we could ever possibly truthfully look at our lives and the aspects of our activity with any sort of objectivity.
Oh, absolutely right. That it, apart from God helping us, we will not see ourselves clearly. And we need desperately for that help. To turn to Him and ask for that help is really essential. Critical.
I think impossible, actually.
I don't know if I would say
impossible, because God can break through. God can break through and reveal that to me without Him first moving me to pray, reveal to me my own rebelliousness without first moving me to pray.
So are you, have you just eliminated choice then?
No. No, we're still choosing. But what needs to happen is we have to become aware of who we are. How do I clear my vision so that I can see clearly who I am, my rebelliousness? And it really takes an act of God to do that. He can, if I pray that God would clear my eyes so I can see my rebelliousness, how was I even moved to pray? Except that God has already somehow acted in my life to get me that far. So God is capable of breaking into our lives, and he does it in a variety of different ways. But one of the ways that he does that is to move us to call upon him to clear our vision.
What does unfutility, if I can coin a phrase, unfutility in a Christian, what feelings smell like?
So his question is, what does unfutility look like, the opposite of futility, look like in a Christian?
Well, it's a sense of meaning, a sense of fulfillment, satisfaction, all those the sense of right being. And that is that things are right with the world. And only through an act of God does that happen. Basically, it's peace with God.
So that doesn't really have much to do with the exterior circumstances then.
It has. Right, that's absolutely right. One of my favorite quotes is from Solzhenitsyn, who says, "Thank God for the prison camps." That it was because of his experience, it was because of the horrible circumstances, it was through those that God opened his eyes to the reality of who he was. And so he gets to the place where he's truly thankful to God for that horrible circumstance, and it was in that horrible circumstance that he came to know God and began to develop his faith. Yes, that's very important.
And the world looks at futility as entirely outward circumstances.
Absolutely,
But maybe for a Christian, it's got nothing to do with outward circumstances.
Right, that's really critical, is that as rebels, we want to blame our external circumstances for everything that's wrong in our lives. But, and so it would appear as though if we were to move to a desert isle, everything would be wonderful. But in fact, we take everything with us. There's no accident that, well, let me give you an example. I was a nice guy before I got married. What I mean by that is I had lots of roommates and I got along well with them. Things were reasonably cordial and all that sort of thing. And then I got married and now I'm with someone that I want to stay with for the rest of my life, that not only I want to stay with, but I want to become one with this person. Now, when there are problems, I begin to see, well, let's see, I need to change this. And I couldn't change it. And there were other things that she kept pointing out that were problems, things that I needed to change. Well, all of a sudden, I was not a good guy. And I mean, literally, I was not a good guy. There were things that needed to change in my life. And it wasn't until then that I realized that the way I'd solved that before is if I didn't get along with my roommate, I moved out. I just put distance in between me and my roommate. So if anything ever turned sour, I just avoided it. Well, that's not solving anything. I wasn't a nice guy, but I just had the illusion of being a nice guy. It's always something else is the blame. And as rebels, self-justifying rebels, it's always things exterior to us that are the causes of our problems. It is so hard for us to see that the root of the problem is us. The external circumstances have very little to do with it. They help manifest some things, but they aren't what determine whether I'm nice or not nice.
Well, since this is inherited, I blame my dad. Sorry.
Anything else?
I might have had a quick question. You said, was it looked to be or feeling of non-futileness?
Yes. What is non-futile? Well, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you said, basically, at peace with God. And I was wondering if you could define that, because non-believers, I think, go through periods of time that have a feeling great. I mean, it's just temporary. But they have some sort of, this is a great day, I'm happy, smiling, smiling. And
that's not what I mean. And maybe feeling isn't the term to use, but it's knowledge of peace with God. To know that I have settled things between me and God. Things are resolved. Okay, thanks.